on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
Five Live.
Bloke in a quiff staring at me, he's brought me a coffee, so that'll be movies then.
Ask me about the Battle of Midway.
Okay,
so... One of the very few films to be filmed in Sensorround.
Okay.
Was. I think it was only the second. Earthquake was first. Battle of Midway, I think, was second, although I'm sure somebody will correct me on that.
Is that a point that you've mentioned, Dan?
I don't think that made it into the... Is that the one with Charlton Heston?
Charlton Heston's in Earthquake, yeah. He falls down the thing, and he's kind of sacrificial Moses figure in Earthquake, but not in the Battle of Midway. But the Battle of Midway does feature Sensorround, but I can see why the two things would get confused. If you've overlooked that in the programme, I think you need to go back in and re-edit it,
because
I think it's significant.
This email from Neil Barnett says, Simon and Mark, don't forget when you say hello to Jason Isaacs in your movie conversation to wish him a happy birthday. He was 44 this week.
44.
Happy birthday, Jason Isaacs.
You're older than me.
He listens on a podcast every week, wherever he is. He said, and Neil says, the video podcast, great entertainment, reminds me of Statler and Waldorf from The Muppet Show. Actually, I've just remembered we're supposed to put more lights on because we're on the video podcast.
You go ahead. I was just told to sit on orange, and that is what I'm doing.
Sit on orange.
I'm sitting on orange.
The orange microphone. Yes. So this is available live, obviously. The podcast, downloadable fairly shortly. And the video podcast takes a bit longer to sort of chop it all together. We're going to put some lights on.
You got a man to come in to turn the lights on because you couldn't be bothered to get up and walk over there.
Cable doesn't
stretch
that far.
You are just living now in the lap of luxury.
We have staff to do this.
I am Simon Mayo. I want coffee and lights.
Coming up, Black Gold, Are We Done Yet? Ocean's 13, Taking Liberties, The Chum Scrubber, The Tiger's Tale. As you know, it's directed by John Borman, and everyone knows that anything that's directed by John Borman, that Mark will not go into that movie with an open mind, correct?
No, I think that's completely unfair.
Oh, right. So you thought this is a John Borman movie? Hey, you know, it might be fantastic.
Interestingly enough, they've just recently re-released Catch If You Can on DVD, which was, you know, John Borman's earliest movie with the Dave Clark Five. Well, with Dave Clark. And that's actually not bad. And Hell in the Pacific is not bad at all. And Leo the Last is not bad. And Deliverance is great. The problem was that when Deliverance was great, somebody, probably Michael Cement, Michel Simon, came up to him and said, Jeune, you are great. It's not just that you are great, you are an auteur. And that was it. The minute he suddenly got it into his head that he was an auteur, it was Zardoz. It was Exorcist to the Heretic. It was Where the Heart Is. It was Excalibur. Let's all do it together.
That's good.
You brought me back.
Excalibur, I like that.
No, you don't.
I did. I thought it was very good. Number 10 this week in the box office chart in the hit parade, we have Cheney Coombe.
Now, bear in mind two things. Firstly, I've been away. Secondly, if this is an Eros film, then it would have been screened, but I've been away for 2 weeks, so I don't know. All I know it is an Amitabh Bachchan movie, and I think it's set in London. I think the plot is that he sets up a restaurant, but if somebody has seen it, please let us know, because I do think Amitabh Bachchan is a great... you know, movie idol. So please give us a review of Cheney Coombe. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong if you've seen it.
Number 9 is Mr. Bean's Holiday. Number 8 is 28 Weeks Later,
which I really like, and I'm really enjoying the fact that it's done so well, because I think it's funny. Well, this will come up in a little bit, but the idea of making political movies that are preaching to the converted. Well, 28 Weeks Later is a political movie that is not preaching to the converted. It's playing to a mainstream audience. I think it's done really well. Good for it.
Number 7, Bridge to Terabithia.
So John from the production team here, or I think our Lord and Master, said that apparently he went to see it and it went down really well. Now,
with his young children.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Just before taking them in to see 28 Weeks Later.
Yeah, my worry has always been that I think that something happens in the middle of Bridge of Terabithia that I think is out of kilter with the rest of the story, and I think that the movie hasn't quite earned the right to do it. But we have had many people say, look, I took my kids to see it, they were perfectly fine. And I do agree with the underlying point, which is that proper kids' entertainment should deal with terrible subjects like loss, tragedy, death, bereavement, all those sorts of
things. Whichever one of those might come up.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm using a whole load of them. So, as you know. So what I'm saying is... No, but you just need to be aware... I'm sorry, this is something I do think is true. If you're a parent, you do need to know what you're taking your kids to see. And I'm sure that if you saw the trailer for Bridge to Terabithia, which just looks like hobbledy-gobbledy, you know, hobbity-tosh, you would be slightly surprised by the film itself. But I have had many people tell me I have to go back and reassess it. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back and reassess it.
Thought you might. Number 6 is The Hitcher.
Well, you know, nobody needed to remake The Hitcher. I have really fond memories of seeing The Hitcher first time. I mean, the remake is just like, you know, it's a chase movie with nothing else going on. The first time I saw the Hitcher was in Cardiff. I'd gone out to visit my brother and I went to see The Hitcher and it was absolutely wonderful. And I went straight back and saw it again the next day just to figure out whether it really was every bit as good as I thought it was. A really, really nihilistic thriller. And the remake is nothing like that.
Zodiac at 5?
I think it's a great, intelligent, smart movie. Didn't do good in America, presumably because it was, you know, it's open ended. And as you know, I mean, I'm not giving the ending away here. They didn't find the Zodiac killer, but I think it's a really intelligent movie. It's a serial killer movie that doesn't have a serial killer at the centre of it.
And it didn't do good in America.
No, but it was. But it did gooder over here.
Where's it done goodest?
It's done goodest, I think, here, probably, right. Because here we are gooderest for it.
Paradise Lost at number four.
Now, I was away, and I haven't been to see Paradise Lost. I have, however, read the outrage.
Could go and see it in your spare time.
Yeah, which spare time was that? The spare time that I had during half term when I was looking at... No, I should have taken my kids with me to go and see the new torture porn movie, yeah. And can I just say, incidentally, I am utterly sick of reading articles about the rise of torture porn. You know what?
Is that what this is?
I don't know. I haven't seen the film, but people keep citing it in there. Keep saying, oh, the rise of these terrible movies. They're not terrible. I haven't seen Paradise Lost. I will go and see it. But the movies that people say, like Hostel and the rest of it, they're not evil punishment. They're just stupid. They're stupid adolescent rubbish. They've always been around. They're not, you know, the end of civilization as we know it. Eli Roth's just a nitwit. I think he's a quite amiable nitwit, and I liked him very much.
I thought we quite liked him.
We did.
When he came in, we told him. It was great.
Yeah, no,
but now we don't.
Cabin Fever, great.
Yes.
Hostel, and then since then, and the Tarantino thing, because he's in the new Tarantino movie, and he's briefly in it, and him and Tarantino become very good friends, and nitwit now. But there we go, you know.
Spider-Man 3, at 3.
It's the summer of threequels, and, you know, way too long, way too boring. You didn't enjoy it, even though you said you did.
Wedding Days at 2.
Didn't see it. Looking forward to it. Looks absolutely marvellous. I'm sure that Oscar Wilde had a hand in the script, and certainly the poster doesn't in any way remind me of all those post-American Pie movies.
Now, the UK's number one's Pirates, of course. And
it's what? It's Pirates.
It is.
Is it? It's gone straight in at number one.
Pirates 3. If you want to know in gruesome detail what Marx thinks, you'll have to check the podcast or the vodcast. They're in all its glory. Richard, on this email, for the grumbling quiff, he says, I live in Spain. Uh-huh. Last week, due to an unfortunate series of events, I found myself watching Pirates the Caribbean 3 in our local multiplex.
In Spanish.
And you know what? It wasn't so bad. Once Orlando and IKEA Knightley have been dubbed, they actually...
That's very good. I'm sorry, I'm going to make a note of that. IKEA Knightley, I cannot believe that I haven't thought of that joke before.
Copyright Richard Clark.
Richard, every time I say it, I'm going to say, copyright Richard Clark, IKEA Knightley. Boy, did I miss a trick.
Once they've been dubbed, they actually acted very well. Of course, I hadn't a clue what was going on at any point throughout the whole film, but the special effects made up for it. I know if I'd seen it in English, I'd have been left feeling conned by Hollywood for making me pay for a bad script and acting, but instead I left feeling mildly entertained with a guilty feeling that I didn't know enough Spanish. So I have a suggestion. Mm-hmm. When they bring out Pirates 4, 5 and 6, go and watch them in Arabic, Greek, Japanese. At least then you won't have to endure Ikeira and Orlando with their real voices, and you'll never know if the script was written by a toddler or if it was just your lack of knowledge of the foreign language.
Can I tell you, and this is very, very pertinent, when I was in Cannes, I had to go and see Pirates of the Caribbean, and I said, you know what, I can see it in Cannes in French, it's not going to make any difference, right? It's not going to make any more sense in English. But somebody said, no, Mark, in order for this to be done properly, you have to see it in English. You have to go to Nice to see it in English. And I thought, yeah, actually, you're right. You are right. In fact, I have to see it in English. But as a whole part of me thought, I would enjoy it more in French. Because as Richard Clark just said there, if you can understand the dialogue, it's worse. If you can't understand, if it's just, oh, yeah, oh, 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 and then Keith Richards, it would have been funnier. Or at least it would have been, you know, passable. But when you can actually understand what they're saying, it's worse.
This email from Martin in Old Portsmouth. Dear Simon and Sprout...
Old Portsmouth.
Old Portsmouth. It's the smart end. Simon and Sprout Boy, with reference to Mark's Pirates rant last week, or the week before. I haven't been to see the film. I have better things to do with my time. That paint might not dry properly if I don't watch it. And, well, there's only so many times you can hit yourself on the thumb with a lump hammer before the novelty wears off. Yeah. However, several members of my staff did go. See, I told you it was the smart end. Yeah. Most felt profoundly cheated of both time and money and conceded that I was right to listen to the reviewers who get paid to suffer that we might not.
Exactly.
Giving a kind of a religious
feeling. He is.
Feeling.
I'm with him all the way. I'm going to old Portsmouth this evening.
Mark, your sacrifice, he says, was not in vain.
Good.
One girl, however, thought it was brilliant, but probably not quite as good as Curse of the Black Pearl, and she even cried at the end. Obviously, I will be sacking her. I was wondering if Mark would speak on my behalf in the unlikely event that this should come to an industrial tribunal.
Oh, you know, I will stand up. I will absolutely go to court for this. But as I've said, I think it's the kind of thing that warrants, you know, custodial sentences, and I will absolutely stand up in court. And I'm a doctor, you know. The only thing, so am I. No, you're not. You're not? Did you get an honorary doctorate?
We've done this
Oh, no,
before.
Okay, fine. But the only thing I can tell you is the last time that I stood up as an expert witness in anything, right, as Dr. Kermode, right, was when they had the Last House on the Left appeal. We went in with 16 seconds of cuts. We appealed against the cuts. Dr. Kermode was the expert witness, and we lost so badly that not only did the cuts stand up, they doubled them. 32 seconds by the time we left.
So
went in with
success. That's how good you are.
Yeah, I was like, you know, a nuclear weapon of badness.
Michelle on this says, Simon, I was so appalled by pirates and scared at the prospect of even more that I've started an online petition to try and stop them.
Good.
To try and stop any more too long, too little plot, too much Keith Richards, too much fake tan movies being made.
Good.
And it's a very long email address, which I can't actually... can't be bothered to read it out. It may seem drastic, but I think it's important to stand up for what you believe in. Please mention it on the show. All right, well, I will do it.
John.
It's www.ipetitions.com/petition/savejohnnydeppnow.
That's a URL, not an email address.
I know. Sorry, I got slightly confused.
Okay.
Movies to come then. We will do Ocean's 13, followed by...
Sorry, I'm just the people behind are just amazed that I knew what an URL was, but I wasn't, because somebody in the control room said, "Tell him it's a URL." What does that mean? Is that like a USP?
Yeah, it's exactly the same as that.
Is it on broadband?
Yeah, exactly the same.
We don't have that where I live.
Ocean's 13 Plus.
The Tiger's Tail, the new Jean de Beaumont movie.
Plus,
are we done yet?
Plus,
the Chum Scrubber. Plus, Taking Liberties.
What about that coffee movie? Are you going to do that?
Well, if we get time, we've got a lot of stuff to get through.
And we've only got a half an hour. Maybe we'll just leak into Drive a bit. I'm sure they won't mind. Reviews with Mark coming up in just a moment. But before we go any further, last week neither you or I were here as we were enjoying compulsory family fun time.
That's right.
So we left the programme in the capable hands of Phil Williams and James King. Just have a listen to this.
Cast your mind back a week or so to the Cannes Film Festival. People listening last week will have heard Mark Kermode's thoughts on the whole thing, including this rant.
Can I start with a complaint?
Yes.
Okay. So the other day, I'm in this screening room, right, and James King's sitting next to me, and James, I say, how's it going, James? He says, oh, I think I finally understand what you mean about the weariness of Cannes. I really feel it's been very hard this year. And I said, oh, this is, you know, I've started to sympathise with the child, you know, because, hey, he's finally grown up into a man and realised that Cannes is a real ordeal, yeah? So then I find out this morning that we can't do this transmission now from Radio France, but we have to do it from the flat that James has been staying in, and James has led me to believe that he's been staying in some kind of student hovel and things are very, very difficult for him, exactly like I did when I worked for the radio for all those years doing the Cannes coverage. I get to James's flat. It's absolutely wonderful. He's got this bijou fourth floor apartment overlooking the Rue d'Antibes. It's far more central than the place I'm staying in. It's lovely and cool. It's really, really nice. I don't know what that boy is complaining about, and he's gone home already.
Let's do the box office top 10.
Before you do the box office top 10, last thing on my complaint, right? As vodcast viewers will see, I'm literally sitting on a balcony surrounded by jasmine. I mean, the man has flowers. I've been staying in the Novotel. This is a total class distinction, and I demand that James King is fired immediately.
Okay, so he wants your head on a plate. Your response is?
I'm sure people at home, their hearts are bleeding for the fact that Mark had to stay in a Novotel. How terrible for him, and doing his culture show reviews from the south of France. I mean, that's hard work. I'm sure people at home would feel so sorry for him right now. I did have a quite pleasant apartment. It did have jasmine on the balcony, but what can I say? I'm like J-Lo, you know, she wants white candles and everything draped in white. I demanded jasmine on my balcony.
And all the yellow fruit pastels fished out of the packet.
Exactly. It was a pleasant time, it was a pleasant flat, and I don't feel sorry for Mark at all because he's famous and on the telly.
Apparently his hotel was so bad that he was so incensed by it. It was like a scene from The Exorcist, which is quite apt.
It wasn't bad at all. He gets the red carpet treatment when he goes to Cannes.
So James says you get the red carpet treatment because you're famous and on the telly.
Well, how would James know? He's too busy being J-Lo with his jasmine. James never came to my hotel. My hotel was perfectly fine. It just didn't have jasmine and, you know, hot and cold running money in every room.
James, what do you have to say about that?
I think think the lesson I've learned from this is never try and lie to your parents. You know,
exactly.
I could sit here and, you know, I could try and defend myself. I could make out that I had a terrible time. But you know what? I'm just going to sit here and eat humble pie, and I'm going to say, Mark, I am the Michael Corleone to your Don Vito Corleone. I am the Luke Skywalker to your Yoda. I am the Mini-Me to your Dr. Evil. I do owe it all to you. You are my mentor, and I was wrong.
Wow. That's just strange, isn't it?
That was an unnatural moment.
Have you tied him to a chair and hit him with a rubber hose?
No. I think you're just at Radio 1, aren't you, or something?
I am, yeah. Can you hear the music that the kids are listening to in the background?
Sounds like a creche.
And what is that music that the kids are listening to? Is it the Wiggles?
That's it, yeah.
James, thanks a lot.
Cheers.
It's 20 to 4. We should do a movie or two.
Well,
no, actually, you should do a movie or two. How about Ocean's 13? I've seen the poster. There's lots of famous, lovely-looking people.
Yeah, exactly.
In it.
And in a way, having seen the poster, you don't really need to say what the poster is. It's all those famous people looking really famous. Okay?
George and Brad.
When I was in Cannes, they showed Ocean's 13. They showed it on Thursday morning. And it was in the middle of, you know, a week of, you know, international cinema, like Romanian films about abortion and a Korean film about abduction and another film about suicide. You know, no, I mean, no, good films, but, you know.
I'm sure.
So everyone went in thinking, hey, you know, it's going to be two-week kickback, right? Two-hour kickback. You know, we're just going to sit there. We're just going to watch. And they're quite fun. You know, the first Ocean's 11 was better than the original Ocean's 11. The first, no, the remake of Ocean's 11. Ocean's 12 was awful. I mean, that was really, really awful. But Ocean's, the first remake took something like $444 million. The second one, which was rubbish, took $350. So it's the math still adds up. So of course we're going to get Ocean's 13. So we all went in a really, really good mood. And a review came out just after that, I think the next day, in the Times. It said, hey, it's great. It's 4 stars. You know, great. And bless him. I know the guy who wrote the review, I think, is a very smart guy. He wasn't reviewing the film. He was reviewing the fact that it was Thursday. And we were all going home the next day because nothing else can explain a positive review of Ocean's 13 because it's all over the shop. The story, for what there is Ruben. You remember the Ruben character in the old guy, okay? At the beginning of the movie, he's in bed. He's very sick because he has been wronged by an evil character played by Al Pacino. Al Pacino is on board because the movie is produced by Jerry Weintraub. And Jerry Weintraub, who instead he produced Cruising, the William Friedkin film Cruising, which is a great film, just been restored, premiered in Cannes, absolutely great. Jerry Weintraub knows everybody. So he says, hey, I want Al Pacino to be the sort of the new person in the Ocean's movies, but he's not the 13th cog in the wheel. Wheel in the cog? What's it? Cog in the machine. The 13th person is Andy Garcia, who kind of was the bad guy before, but now sides with the good guys, who they're going to get their own back on Al Pacino and sort him out. I mean, I don't know why Don Cheadle is doing an English accent in this film. That character doesn't need to be English. I mean, actually, it just sounds like he's challenged in some strange way. It's like he can't actually form words properly, and some of them come out as can't. And something come back hand. So he's kind of, you know, he's transatlantic. He talks a bit like Clive Barker, oddly enough. I mean, Clive Barker, who grew up in North London, but speaks like he comes from San Francisco via Barnett for bizarre reasons. So here's the main problems with Ocean 13. And let me say at the beginning, it's not as bad as Ocean's 12, but really very few things would be as bad as Ocean's 12. It's way too long. And I went in there thinking, come on, you know, let's kick back, let's relax, let's have fun. You know, let's have the famous people doing the fun stuff, all that kind of thing, great. And when there's the moment, which is in the trailer, in which Andy Garcia says, George Clooney says, you know, are you ready? And Andy Garcia says, you know, I was born ready. And George sort of looks and he rolls his eyes. And, oh, you know, so that moment is in the trailer, and it is the whole film. The whole film
is that the best bit of the film?
It is, and really is, and it's in the trailer. And all it is it's a collection of very, very famous people being very famous in very short bursts in Las Vegas. Now, a number of things about this. Firstly, if truth be told, Las Vegas needs to be wiped from the face of the earth because it is an evil abomination and, you know, bad and a blight upon, you know, mankind, obviously. That's why Mike Figgis's film Leaving Las Vegas is so great. The only way to make a film about Las Vegas is to hate the place. It's foul. It's, you know, it's a capital of, you know, foulness. Not a good thing about it.
Well, like gambling and the mafia.
Yeah, I mean, Nevada would benefit from if you just carried straight on. You went through Death Valley, through Stovepipe Wells, and you just kept going, and then there wasn't Las Vegas.
Is this the Methodist in you coming out?
Well, it's the human being in me. There was an episode of Doctor Who in which they took an entire town and put it on the moon. Well, if they can do it in Doctor Who, why can't they do it with Las Vegas? There is no reason for Las Vegas to exist. You know that film with, Warren Beatty, Bugsy? At the end of it, they say, oh, you know, Bugsy, but hey, 50 years on, Las Vegas thrived. That's a good thing? That's like saying 50 years on, herpes still exists. That's not a good thing. It's like, I don't understand why everyone thinks, oh, it's just great. It's not like it was in the old school days. No, of course it is. It's an evil, bad place full of gangsterism and gambling. Point one.
Actually, I can't argue with that.
So exactly. Exactly. On. Fine. Okay. Point two. This is not a film. This is a guest list. Okay? This is what it is. Jerry Weintraub, the producer. Jerry Weintraub used to organise concerts for Elvis. And any man who organised concerts for Elvis is okay in my book. He also produced Cruising. And that's how he's friends with Al Pacino. Although Al Pacino won't talk about Cruising for reasons which you have to see the film itself to fully understand. But what we're meant to applaud is, look who he got. He got Brad back. He got the other guy back. He got Andy Garcia. He got Al Pacino. And then, here we go, right? I'm kind of all right. It's perfectly fine. He's got all these people. It is rubbish. It's going to be too long. And then the black hole comes in. It's like, you know that bit in Armageddon where you can feel it rumbling from something really bad is coming, right? And the camera starts going behind somebody. There's a new character going to be introduced, right? They turn around. It's Julian Sands!
No.
Yes!
He's not one of the...
That's a whole film. It's like watching a... Shwoom! It's like you go through the anti-gravity thing and suddenly, through the look, Julian Sands has got work again.
I haven't seen him for years.
No, I know. I thought he'd got that gone through...
Eaten by a spider.
Yeah, several times. So here, right, I'm in Las Vegas with Julian Sands.
Oh, bless him.
I'm sweating. I'm losing half my body weight through my palms. Right, I gave 4 stars rather than 5 stars to Leaving Las Vegas, which I loved as a film. Somebody said, why didn't you give it 5 stars? Well, so Julian Sands is in it. He's only in it for like 12 minutes, but, you know, you have to take a star off for that. And now here he is back again. So that fine. That's it. And then it goes on for way too long. And on a serious point, Ellen Barkin is treated very badly in this film. The whole point about Ellen Barkin is she's a character who's meant to sort of maligned for the fact that she's an older woman who has this nymphomaniacal lust for Matt Damon, who appears to be wearing the stick-on nose that Nicole Kidman won the Oscar with in The Hours, you know, when she plays Virginia Woolf. You know, honk. This is, you know, the comedy nose. And there's a lot of stuff made about the comedy nose. But he puts a little bit of spray on, presumably Blue Stratos or something, and he walks in the room. And Ellen Barkin can't stand up for falling down because she's so overcome with lust for Matt Damon. No. And then the film drags on, and then 2 hours later it stops. And
that or Pirates?
Pardon me?
That or Pirates?
Oh, that obviously. I mean, because there are at least some bits in it that are not completely rubbish, and it is better than Ocean's 12.
What else is out?
Well, also getting Post to Space, Taking Liberties, which is a documentary about the erosion of civil liberties and freedoms, rights, speech, all that sort of stuff under the Blair government. Now, clearly, you can tell from the outside and from the poster and all the rest of it, this is a partisan work. But we live now in an age of partisan documentaries, thanks to Michael Moore. Incidentally, on the subject of Michael Moore, I did see Sicko when I was in Cannes, which is his new documentary about how rubbish the American health service, or lack of it, is. And I have to say, as a Michael Moore work goes, it's actually one of the better ones. It is quite funny, except for the bits when he comes to London and he gets treated by a National Health Service, which clearly he's gone to Narnia, because there's this fantastic National Health Service in which if you have a cough and you're somewhere, they'll send a taxi, they'll take you to a 4-star hotel. Doctors who earn $1 million a year and drive Jaguars will look after you, and on the way back they'll give you a cash load of money and say, go home now. But other than that,
do you get a going home present like it?
You do. I mean, it's a classic Michael Moore thing. He's very funny until he talks about something that you know about. I mean, anything at all. And then you suddenly realise that he's really skimming the surface, and it makes you wonder about everything else. But that said, the thesis of it's perfectly fine. You know, national health, public health, good. Private health, not good. So that's fine. Anyway, so Taking Liberties, which is a partisan documentary about the alleged erosion of civil liberties under the Blair government. And basically what it does is, it's very rough and ready. It's very British. It takes a sort of DV footage of protesters being arrested and new interviews and archive footage, stuff from the television, and intercut with a couple of quite funny film clips. One very good thing of Tony Hancock saying, does Magna Carta mean nothing to you? Did she die in vain? You can laugh now. That's a very good joke.
In its original form.
Okay, fine. I don't do Tony Hancock. Anyway, so here's a clip. Which
in your vast wardrobe of voices. Do you keep voices in a wardrobe?
I don't think so.
No.
You might do in
your vast array of voices, you haven't got a Hancock.
I can't do Tony Hancock. No, I can't do Tony Hancock. But
Repertoire was obviously what I was looking for.
It was. Thank you very much. And somebody just told you that from the control room. Mm. Yes, they have, because I saw your eyes do that thing that they do when somebody speaks in your ear.
I am always hearing voices.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I know. Fine. So,
is it a good film or not?
Hang on, I'm going to play you a clip before I judge it.
Go on then.
Okay, so the cases it goes through, like I said, the right to protest being taken away, you know, right to science, you get the guy getting thrown out of the Labour Party conference because he wants to sort of speak his mind. You get the thing about the exclusion zone around the House of Commons, all that sort of stuff. And we end up with a very interesting, actually, investigation of the NatWest 3 and the extradition of the NatWest 3. Publicity for the film says the most important movie of the decade. And there's a quote on it now from a film critic who said one of the most important films of the year. Let me just make one thing clear. It's not a film. It's a television documentary. Sorry, I know I keep saying this, but it's true. And there is a problem about what's happened with cinema. I admire the rise of documentaries. I don't think that there's no need for this to be in the cinema. So point one. Point two, if you compare it with stuff like, for example, the Michael Moore films, it doesn't have quite the dramatic clout sometimes, but it is much more balanced. It is terribly British. There is something very, very charming about seeing, you know, English tea-drinking protesters being moved outside. So they clearly have every right to demonstrate it. And in the end, what the film ends up as being is a sort of call to arms, but in a very genteel sort of British way. It says that ever since World War II, we've had these rights to, you know, free speech, rights to protest, right to say what you want, which is completely enshrined. And the documentary claims that they've been, I think, claims very convincingly that they've been eroded. And it's sort of a call to arms, but in a very British kind of arms, a kind of call to going out and doing a bit of a demonstration. And I think on that level, it works very, very well. I mean, as somebody who has served their time on, you know, various demonstrations about, you know, fight this, fight that, fight the other, great. I'm very big believer in campaigns working. And one of the things that documentary does is it starts with some people attempting to protest against the Iraq war and their coach being stopped and their coach being turned back, and it ends up with a sort of surprise conclusion to that case.
Clearly you can campaign against the Iraq war, as many people do.
You can. Clearly you can. And there are a couple of moments in it when, for example, we have the narration, which is provided by David Morrissey.
Hello to David Morrissey, for a couple of weeks.
Who's very good. There are some moments in which it appears through the use of animated graphics that comparisons are being made with Britain today and Germany pre-war. And you think, hang about a minute, those comparisons aren't being made. And there is a moment in which Tony Blair is seen in the House of Parliament saying, look, I'm sorry, this is not a police state. And you think, no, it isn't a police state. That's absolutely right. But the funny thing about the documentary is it walks a very thin line between huge dramatic overstatement and, as I said, a very kind of English protest. And in the end, I think the English kindness of it wins out. My problem, if I have a problem, is that I don't know that that makes it a great film. But I think what it does make it is a good, interesting look at, you know, the need to protect civil liberties. It's not saying that we now live in a Big Brother state. It's not saying that we now live in a police state. It's not saying we now live in, you know, we don't. None of these things are true. But what it is saying is defend your right to protest.
If I don't want to see another Don Cheadle movie, and if I don't want to see a documentary, is there anything else?
The Tiger's Tale. It is a film.
And what if I don't want to see a John Bull?
Would you want me to review it? Or do you want me to move on?
Oh yeah, no. You ought to do the right thing.
I mean, I did watch it, so you know, if you don't mind. I mean, I know it's got 3 minutes of your life and everything, but I sat through the film. Okay, I want to be clear about the John Boorman thing, because at the beginning of this, you upbraided me for saying that I'm closed-minded about John Boorman. It is absolutely true that I am on record as saying he's the worst filmmaker in the world. And
that was where I got it from.
That was where you got it from. My principle is like this: what happened was he started out as a good nuts and bolts hack filmmaker, good exploitation sort of stuff, you know, point blank brilliant. And then he made Deliverance, and then he was told he was an auteur, and after that he just went off on his own track, and it was this ethereal mythical track that did involve Zardoz, the Emerald Forest, Where the Heart Is. I mean, just really terribly films that just were screaming out to be laughed at, but films which were absolutely championed by, for example, the great French film academic Michel Simon, who you know, he's very, you know, yeah, no Michel, no, doesn't work, sorry, can't be doing with it. Okay, so new
does every film. French intellectual have to have a comedy name the way you say it?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Okay.
Michael Cement. Please email in your French academic comedy name. So the story with this is Brendan the Tiger's Tale, the tiger of the title, presumably is the great Celtic tiger, the rising, you know, Celtic economy. Brendan Gleeson plays a chap who realises that he's being followed by a doppelganger. He's a great Irish entrepreneur, but he's being knocked back with his latest deal. He starts being followed by his doppelganger. Oh no, it's a harbinger of death. You know, mythical doppelganger. If you see a doppelganger, it means you're going to die. Turns out, no, it's not a harbinger of death. It is actually a doppelganger who then moves in and takes over his life and takes over his wife. Brendan Gleeson, very good actor. In fact, he made with Borman one of Borman's best recent movies, The General, which was black and white and it was flawed, but it was a return to form for John Borman. This is a return off form for John Borman. It's not one of his most terrible films. I mean, his most recent film before this didn't actually get released. I mean, it was, you know, genuinely unreleasable. There was a funny period when I used to go on about John Borman and everyone thought he was brilliant. And now that's kind of fallen away, and he's just a guy making films. And it is probably true that I have been in the past unfair in my.
Wrong?
No, no, not wrong.
Oh, not wrong. Just
no, no,
unfair.
No. Just unfair. Because as has been said several times, what I've really never forgiven him for is for making The Heretic. But in the case of The Tiger's Tale, it's all over the place. It doesn't know whether it wants to be political, it doesn't know whether it wants to be mythological, it doesn't know whether it wants to be a personal drama, it doesn't know whether it wants to be a great metaphysical drama about Dublin. In the end, it just ends up as being a little bit of nothing very much.
This email from Alan in Buckinghamshire. I seldom disagree with a good doctor, but I have to say that the most stupefying, overrated, coma-inducing tosh I've ever sat through was Deliverance, and I exclude here the total body of work by Peter Greenaway, who single-handedly redefined inaccessible cinema.
No, I mean, the Greenaway argument, I mean, Ken Russell feels the same way about Greenaway, I think. I like Deliverance. I really do like Deliverance. I think it's, you know, it is a classic slice of extreme 70s cinema, but that was it. That was the beginning of the end.
And movie of the week?
Well, from my point of view, I'd say the movie of the week is Taking Liberties.
Right.
It's not, it's
from
a funny,
everyone else's point of view.
Well, if you go and see Ocean's 13, then you're just encouraging them, and when Ocean's 14 comes around, don't come complaining to me.
But as we said before, if the choice is, what should we go and see? Shall we see Ocean's 13 or Pirates 3?
Oh, well, Ocean's 13, obviously, or Pirates 3, but that is, you know.
The vodcast and the podcast will be available shortly. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.